And I said, okay, and I passed the ad up. And I must say, it took great courage at the time, because I needed the money. I was writing, and I needed to be freed creatively. I was working on a nonfiction version of the Warren Report.
That's Woody Allen in the summer of 1968, 4 years after the publication of the Warren Report, and he's getting a big laugh for suggesting that the Warren Report was an obvious work of fiction. If you were a self-respecting free thinker or progressive in 1968, that's what you believed about the Warren Report, not because any of the report's central claims had been proved false, but because America was coming apart at the seams and the public's faith in American government and institutions was in free fall. Just a few months before Woody Allen cracked this joke, Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy had both been assassinated. The idea that all these recent American assassinations were unrelated and were just happening randomly was getting increasingly hard for people to swallow. American casualties in Vietnam reached a peak in 1968, and President Johnson had announced that he wouldn't be running for re-election. It was clear to the public that the Johnson administration had been systematically lying about the situation in Vietnam, so the idea that it had also lied about the Kennedy assassination didn't seem all that far-fetched. The first conspiratorial books about the assassination had appeared by the summer of 1968, and some of them had become bestsellers. These books certainly seemed to present evidence that some kind of conspiracy had occurred, especially if you hadn't read them, or if you'd read them without entertaining the possibility that their authors might be lying to you too, or perhaps lying to themselves. In this general atmosphere of distrust, the Warren Report had become a kind of whipping boy for the American public's paranoia and discontent. The report was a joke, it was a punchline, and the funniest thing about it, according to the critics, was the single bullet theory. The idea that a single bullet fired by Oswald had gone through both President Kennedy and Governor John Connally. The conspiracy theorists had a name for this bullet. They called it the magic bullet, because they believed that no bullet in the real world could possibly have behaved the way the Warren Commission said this bullet had behaved. If the conspiracy theorists were right to believe that, then the whole Warren Report was a fiction. If, on the other hand, the Warren Commission was right about the single bullet, that would tell us something important about conspiracy theory. It would tell us that the conspiratorial worldview is too narrow and too limited and one-dimensional, and that it fails to grasp how rich and surprising the world can sometimes be. If a single bullet did go through both Kennedy and Connally, then reality itself is more magical than conspiracy theorists are capable of imagining. My name is David Free, and this is The Ghosts of Dallas. Back in the summer of 1964, 4 years before Woody Allen recorded the routine we heard at the beginning of this episode, the young lawyers who had done the bulk of the Warren Commission's investigation sat down to draft the Commission's final report. As each draft chapter was finished, it was circulated among the seven commissioners so they could make comments and suggest changes. By this time, the Commission was under serious time pressure to submit its report. There was a presidential election coming up in November, and President Johnson wanted to get the report finished and out to the public before the campaign started heating up. So the end of September was about as late as the report could be delivered. Earl Warren, the Commission's chairman, was determined to hand the president a unanimous report that all seven commissioners had happily signed off on. But as the draft chapters circulated among the commissioners, it became clear that Earl Warren had a problem. Three members of the commission didn't believe the single bullet theory, and they had no intention of signing off on a report that endorsed this theory as a fact. The commissioners who didn't believe the single bullet theory were Congressman Hale Boggs and Senators Dick Russell and Sherman Cooper. These men hadn't played much of a hands-on role in the commission's investigation. They hadn't attended its hearings very religiously, and none of them seemed to appreciate just how impressive the body of evidence supporting the single bullet theory was. Cooper and Russell disbelieved the single bullet theory for a particularly asinine reason. Both men were Southerners, and Governor John Connally was a Southerner too. And when Connally had testified to the Warren Commission back in April, he'd been adamant that, as far as he remembered, he'd been hit by a separate bullet from the first bullet that hit the president.
And then we had just turned the corner. We heard a shot. I turned to my left. I was sitting in the jump seat. I turned to my left, looked in the back seat. The president had slumped. He had said nothing. Almost simultaneously, as I turned, I was hit. And I knew I'd been hit badly.
That's John Connally on his hospital bed 5 days after the assassination, telling a reporter the same thing that he would tell the Warren Commission. The way he remembered it, he couldn't have been hit by the same bullet that hit Kennedy, because he remembered that there'd been a distinct gap between the moment when he saw that Kennedy had been hit and the moment he realized that he'd been hit himself. Most members of the Warren Commission had no problem seeing that Connally had to be wrong about this point, and they didn't find it all that surprising that a man who'd been shot would have a mixed-up memory of the moment when it happened. I didn't put much faith in Connally's testimony at all, Earl Warren said later. One of the other commissioners, John McCloy, had seen combat during World War I, and he knew how easy it was to become confused when you were under fire. He personally remembered seeing men get badly wounded by bullets and then take several minutes to realize that they'd even been hit. Other people connected with the Warren Commission thought that John Connally had selfish reasons for wanting to believe that he'd been hit by his own bullet. Nicholas Katzenbach, who was the acting attorney general when the Warren Commission was happening, said later on, Connally didn't want to have been hit by the same bullet that had hit Kennedy. I think he was afraid that his blood would be poisoned or something if that happened. Connally insisted on having his own bullet. One thing the Kennedy case teaches us is that eyewitness testimony can quite often be dead wrong. And there's no question that John Connally's testimony on this particular point simply had to be wrong, given the weight of all the hard evidence that showed that he and Kennedy had been hit by the same bullet. Unfortunately, several members of the Warren Commission took the opposite view. They thought that Connally's impressions were somehow reliable enough to trump the hard physical evidence. When Sherman Cooper read the section of the draft report that dealt with the single bullet theory, he wrote a silly little memo that said, "On what basis is it claimed that one shot caused all the wounds? It seems to me that Governor Connally's statement negates such a conclusion. I could not agree with his statement." The fact that Cooper could say this just a month before the submission of the Warren report shows us how shockingly unacquainted some of the commissioners were with the basic evidence of the case. As we saw in the previous episode, by the time the Warren report was being drafted, Arlen Specter had spent 5 months gestating the single bullet theory and testing it from all kinds of different angles, to the point that he and the other attorneys on the staff were now fully satisfied that the single bullet theory wasn't just a theory, but a factual description of what had actually happened. After all that hard analytical work, it was a bit depressing that Sherman Cooper could still talk as if the single bullet conclusion had no basis at all, and it was doubly depressing that Cooper believed that this hard-won conclusion could be, quote, negated by the recollections of a man who was, at the crucial moment, not just being shot at, but actually getting shot. Cooper's doubts about the single bullet theory were not reasonable doubts. They were unreasonable doubts. He was using exactly the same inside-out style of thinking that the conspiracy theorists would later use in their attacks on the Warren Report. The conspiracy theorists would also make a habit of overvaluing the eyewitness testimony. They too would behave as if the recollections of this or that individual witness could somehow negate facts that had already been confirmed from multiple different angles. So you can see how the Warren Report never had much chance of getting a sane reception from the American public when several of the commissioners themselves were already thinking about the evidence in a crazy and infantile way before the report was even published. Dick Russell's stance on the single bullet theory was even more hardline than Sherman Cooper's. Just a week before the Warren Report was submitted to President Johnson, the seven members of the commission sat down to discuss the contents of the report for the final time. Before this meeting happened, Dick Russell had already decided that he wouldn't be signing off on the report. He'd drafted a formal dissent that said, "I do not share the finding of the commission as to the probability that both President Kennedy and Governor Connally were struck by the same bullet." Russell was damned if he was going to be part of any report that endorsed the single bullet theory. On the other hand, Earl Warren was equally determined to give President Johnson a unanimous report, as I've said. So at this final meeting of the Warren Commission, things got pretty heated. Later that night, Dick Russell spoke to his friend Lyndon Johnson on the telephone, and he was still pretty pissed off about how that final meeting of the Warren Commission had gone. You can hear his frustration in the recording of this telephone call. The first voice you're going to hear is President Johnson's. He's wondering why Dick Russell has suddenly cleared out of Washington for the weekend and headed back to his home in Georgia. "Don't you like it up here?" Johnson says.
"Well, you always leave in town. You must not like it up here."
"Well, I've just worn out fighting over that damn report. Well, they were trying to prove that the same bullet that hit Kennedy first was the one that hit Connally. Went through him and through his hand, his bone, and into his leg. And
well, what difference did it make which bullet got Connally?"
"Well, it don't make much difference, but they said that they believe that the commission believed that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connally. Well, I don't believe it."
"I don't either."
That last part of Johnson and Russell's telephone conversation is frequently quoted by the conspiracy theorists. The part where Russell says, "The commission believe that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connally. Well, I don't believe it." And Johnson replies, "I don't either." Conspiracy theorists love the idea that two hard-bitten inside men like President Johnson and Senator Russell privately didn't believe the single bullet theory, or at least said that they didn't believe it. According to the conspiracy theorists, this means that the rest of us shouldn't believe it either. But when you listen to what Johnson and Russell actually said about the single bullet theory, it's abundantly clear that on this subject, both these men were morons. Listen again to what they say about the theory just 2 seconds before they declare that they absolutely don't believe it.
"Well, what difference did it make which bullet got Connally?"
"Well, it don't make much difference."
"What difference does it make which bullet got Connally?" says Johnson. And Russell says, "Well, it don't make much difference." In fact, it made all the difference in the world, and it was staggering that Dick Russell had somehow managed to serve on the Warren Commission without realizing that. As we heard in the previous episode of this podcast, if Kennedy and Connally were not hit by the same bullet, that meant there had to have been a second gunman. As one of the lawyers who worked on the commission put it, "To say that Kennedy and Connally were hit by separate bullets is synonymous with saying that there were two assassins." The fact that Dick Russell still didn't grasp this point was downright embarrassing, and it means that his opinions about the single bullet or any other aspect of the assassination have got to be taken with a generous pinch of salt. There are conspiracy theorists who view Dick Russell as some kind of hero. He's been called the first dissenter. But if you have to quote the opinions of Dick Russell to back up your views about the Kennedy assassination, it's a fair sign that there's something wrong with your views. As worthless as Russell's opinions about the single bullet theory were, though, the fact remained that he was on the commission, and he did have the power to withhold his signature from the final report unless the text of the report was significantly changed to acknowledge his objections. And that's exactly what ended up happening at the commission's final meeting. The section of the report dealing with the single bullet was rewritten and watered down until Russell and Cooper and Boggs were all finally willing to sign off on the report. Later that night, Dick Russell told President Johnson about this last-minute rewrite over the phone.
And so I couldn't sign it, and I said that the government conduct testified directly to the contrary, and I'm not going to approve of that. So I finally made them say there was a difference in the commission in that. A lot of them believed that wasn't so. I don't think you'd be displeased with reports too long, but it's a whole volume.
Unanimous?
Yes, sir. I tried my best to get in a dissent, but they'd come around and trade me out of it by giving me a little old thread of it, too.
You can hear Johnson at the end there asking the only question that really mattered to him, which was, will the report be unanimous? And Russell tells him that yes, it will be, despite his own best efforts to get in a dissent. To stop Russell from dissenting, there was one passage in the draft of the report that had to be altered quite radically. This passage had originally said that there was, quote, compelling evidence that Kennedy and Connolly were struck by the same bullet. The word compelling was removed from the text and it was replaced by the words very persuasive, and a few other weaselly phrases were added to make Russell happy, or at least to make him simmer down enough to sign the report. So Earl Warren did end up getting the unanimous report that he wanted, but that came at a price, because when the Warren report was published, it contained a passage about the single bullet that was nonsensical and that threatened to undermine the commission's whole case. This passage appeared right near the start of the report on page 19, and here's what it said. Quote, although it is not necessary to any essential findings of the commission to determine just which shot hit Governor Connolly, there is very persuasive evidence from the experts to indicate that the same bullet which pierced the president's throat also caused Governor Connolly's wounds. However, Governor Connolly's testimony and certain other factors have given rise to some difference of opinion as to this probability, but there is no question in the mind of any member of this commission that all the shots which caused the president's and Governor Connolly's wounds were fired from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. End quote. When the lawyers who had drafted the report found out that the commissioners had shoehorned this passage into the text at the last minute, they were appalled for several reasons. For one thing, it wasn't true that the commissioner's difference of opinion about the single bullet had been caused by, quote, Governor Connolly's testimony and certain other factors. In truth, there were no other factors involved besides Connolly's testimony. But far more to the point, the insertion of this passage at the last minute meant that the Warren report in its final form made a major claim that just wasn't true. The report now said that it was, quote, not necessary to any essential findings of the commission to determine just which shot hit Governor Connolly. But in fact, it was absolutely pivotal to the commission's findings to believe that Connolly had been hit by the same bullet that hit Kennedy. If he hadn't been, then there were two assassins. None of the seven commissioners claimed to believe that there were two assassins, and yet three of them refused to accept the theory that you had to accept if there were not two assassins. The whole thing was a triumph of sloppy thinking, and it gave a large piece of free ammunition to all the conspiracy theorists who were aching to discredit the report from the moment it was published. As I've explained in previous episodes of this podcast, the conspiracy theorists had a variety of reasons for not wanting to believe that a lone gunman had killed the president. Some of them didn't want to believe it for political reasons, and some of them didn't want to believe it for psychological reasons, because it just violated their sense of how the world worked. From the moment the Warren Report came out, these people were gunning for it. The Warren Report was like the Death Star to them. It was a big, fat symbol of imperial evil, and they wanted to blow it up. And right from the start, the single bullet theory seemed to be the weakest and most vulnerable thing about the Warren Report. If the Warren Report was the Death Star, the single bullet theory was the thermal exhaust port. If you could get down into the service trench and score a direct hit on the single bullet theory, you could blow up the whole report and turn yourself into the Luke Skywalker of the conspiratorial movement. And at first, it did appear that it would be a pretty easy assignment to take out the single bullet theory. After all, the theory sounded like it was obviously made up. It sounded like something that the commission had desperately concocted on the fly to patch up a gaping hole in its lone assassin story. In fact, that's what a lot of the early conspiratorial criticism of the single bullet theory really boiled down to. It boiled down to just complaining about the sheer unlikeliness of the single bullet theory, as if its unlikeliness somehow proved that it was untrue. For example, in 1966, the journalist Andrew Kopkind wrote that, quote, "The case for a lone assassin rests on the unlikely hypothesis that a single bullet struck President Kennedy and Governor Connally." Kopkind seemed to think that just because the single bullet theory struck him as unlikely, that meant there was something objectively wrong with it. Even today, people are still making the same argument. For example, on one of the biggest conspiratorial websites about the assassination, here's what you're told about the single bullet theory. Quote, "The severe implausibility of the single bullet theory proves that President Kennedy was shot by more than one gunman." There's an obvious fallacy in this line of argument, and the best response to this fallacy that I've ever read came from the Warren Commission attorney Wesley Liebler, who I've mentioned a couple of times before in this podcast. Here's what Liebler wrote about the supposed implausibility of the single bullet theory. Quote, "Plausibility has no innate qualities. It depends on what alternative hypotheses are available. The question must always be plausible as compared to what. Explanations that seem dubious at first look better if all other possibilities are even more unlikely. The Warren Commission staff," Liebler concluded, "opted for the single bullet theory because all the alternatives were more implausible. They opted for it, in other words, because they believed it best explained what actually happened." Everything Liebler says there is worth listening to, but my favourite part of that quote is what he says at the end. "The Warren Commission staff opted for the single bullet theory because they believed it best explained what actually happened." What Liebler usefully reminds us of there is that something did actually happen in Dealey Plaza that day. Somebody fired the shots that hit Kennedy and Connally. And in the end, we can't dodge the responsibility of settling on the best available explanation of what happened. If the best explanation sounds unlikely, it's still a lot better than having no explanation at all. These might sound like elementary points, but if you spend too much time reading the works of the conspiracy theorists, you can find yourself starting to lose sight of basic stuff like this. Conspiracy theorists are very good at telling you what didn't happen in Dealey Plaza, or what couldn't have happened, according to them. But they get so caught up in discussing the microscopic improbabilities of the official story that they seem to think we can indefinitely put off the moment of understanding what did happen until we can find some answer that will satisfy every little finicky preconception they have about how the world is supposed to work. They seem to think that just because they haven't found an answer that satisfies them yet, that means the rest of us should have to live without an answer too. They seem to think we should all just go back to the drawing board and stay there forever. Another writer who I've mentioned before in this podcast, is John McAdams, who used to reply to the Kennedy conspiracy theorists with a simple two-word mantra, think scenario. In other words, conspiracy theorists need to do more than just give us their micro quibbles about the official story. They need to give us their scenario, and it needs to be better than the already established one. Something sure as hell happened in Dealey Plaza, and it's about time the conspiracy theorists told us what it was. But as we've seen, one surefire way of identifying a conspiracy theorist is that when you ask them the question, okay, so what did happen, they'll always have trouble giving you a straight answer. Unlike the conspiracy theorists, though, the Warren Commission couldn't dodge its obligation to say exactly what it believed had happened in Dealey Plaza, according to the best evidence. If what had happened struck some people as improbable, that was reality's fault, not the Warren Commission's. As Wesley Liebler rightly pointed out, plausibility is a relative concept. The only question that matters is plausible compared to what? And if you try to explain what happened in Dealey Plaza without using the single bullet theory, you're not left with a more plausible scenario. You're left with no scenario at all. You're just left with a bunch of unanswered questions that don't add up to anything. Questions like, if the bullet that went through Kennedy didn't go into Connolly, where else did it go? Why has it never turned up? Conspiracy theorists like to refer to the Warren Commission's single bullet as the magic bullet, but as some of the more clever defenders of the Warren Commission have pointed out, the only truly magic bullet in this case is the bullet imagined by the conspiracy theorists, the bullet that flew out of President Kennedy's throat at around 1,500 feet per second and then suddenly vanished into thin air before hitting what was right in front of it, which was Governor Connolly's back. A bullet that passed through Kennedy and then failed to hit Connolly or anything else in the limousine really would have been magical. It really would have defied the laws of physics, as the conspiracy theorists fondly imagine that the real bullet did. You also have to ask, if Oswald didn't fire that single bullet that went through both Kennedy and Connolly, then who fired the other bullet that must have been fired at almost exactly the same instant? Where was this second gunman shooting from? Why didn't anybody see him? Why did the bullet that he fired leave behind no forensic trace of its existence in Connolly or anywhere else? If you take the single bullet theory out of the equation, the unanswered questions go on and on. When you think about it, the claim that Kennedy and Connolly were not struck by the same bullet is vastly more unlikely than the claim that they were. Unfortunately, though, conspiracy theorists don't like to think too much about the plausibility of their own beliefs because they're too busy trying to find tiny little holes in everybody else's. On the face of it, there was one aspect of the single bullet theory that really did qualify as glaringly and objectively improbable, and this was the almost intact condition of the bullet found on Connolly's stretcher. According to the Warren Commission, this bullet had gone through both Kennedy and Connolly, and it had broken Connolly's rib and wrist along the way. For a bullet that had supposedly done all that damage, the stretcher bullet did seem to be in surprisingly good shape. In fact, it looked pretty much intact, almost as if it had never been fired. But only almost. Some conspiracy theorists have been known to call this bullet pristine, but that is an exaggeration. If you look at a photo of it, you can see that it's bent slightly along its length and squashed flat on one side at the base. But the fact remains that when the conspiracy theorists complain that this bullet looks far less damaged than you'd expect it to look, they do seem to have a point. The Warren Commission was concerned about this point too, so it did a series of test firings with Oswald's rifle to see if it could get another bullet to come out looking as undamaged as the stretcher bullet. Photographs of these test-fired bullets were published in the supporting volumes of the Warren Report alongside photographs of the stretcher bullet, and the results did seem to raise some problems for the single bullet theory. For example, one of the commission's ballistics experts fired a bullet from Oswald's rifle into the ribs of an anaesthetized goat, and the goat bullet looked significantly more mangled than the stretcher bullet did. Another expert fired bullets from Oswald's rifle into a tube filled with cotton wadding, and even some of these bullets looked more damaged than the stretcher bullet did. In his 1967 book, 6 Seconds in Dallas, the conspiracy theorist Josiah Thompson reproduced some of the bullet photos that were published by the Warren Commission. One of these photographs showed the stretcher bullet sitting in between two of the bullets that had been fired into the tubes of cotton wadding. The bullet on the left looked slightly less deformed than the stretcher bullet, and the one on the right looked slightly more deformed than the stretcher bullet. And as Thompson reminded the readers of his book, the bullet in the middle of the picture had, according to the Warren Commission, been fired through two people, causing 7 separate wounds and shattering 2 large bones. From one angle, this photograph of the stretcher bullet flanked by the 2 cotton bullets did look damning. But there was one interesting thing about the photograph that Josiah Thompson didn't comment on, which was that the 2 bullets the FBI had fired into the tubes of cotton wadding didn't look exactly the same as each other. As I've said, one of them looked more damaged than the stretcher bullet, and one of them looked less damaged. This should have tipped Thompson off to an important point. If even 2 bullets fired into 2 tubes of cotton wadding looked significantly different from each other, then obviously it was a fool's errand to expect that the stretcher bullet could ever be exactly replicated by any kind of experimental firing. To even begin to do that experiment properly, the Warren Commission would have had to fire a bullet from Oswald's rifle through 2 live men, one sitting in front of the other, and it would have had to be sure to make the bullet miss the first man's bones and go only through his flesh and his muscles, so that the bullet would still be moving at something close to top speed when it came out his throat. And even then, there would have been no guarantee that the bullet would enter the second man at exactly the right angle and would be tumbling through the air in such a way as to enter him back to front instead of nose first. In other words, even if the Warren Commission had been prepared to fire a bullet through 2 live men, the chances that they could have made the bullet follow exactly the same path as Oswald's bullet, so that it would end up looking identical to it, would have been vanishingly small. From the moment that any given bullet leaves the barrel of a rifle, the rest is going to be the very definition of a unique and unrepeatable event. This point was confirmed in 1977, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations decided to conduct another round of test firings with Oswald's rifle to see if it could produce a bullet that resembled the stretcher bullet closely enough to finally satisfy the conspiracy theorists. But the project was abandoned before it could even begin, because when the committee contacted a ballistics lab about running the tests, the lab replied that it would need a very large budget to do the job properly because, quote, the number of shots required to reproduce the chance result of Commission Exhibit 399 could range from 1 up to infinity. Of course, you don't need to be a ballistics expert to see that the condition of the stretcher bullet was a, quote, chance result, and that you could fire Oswald's gun from now until the end of time without ever getting exactly the same result again. It's a fairly obvious point, unless you're a conspiracy theorist. But conspiracy theorists hate the very idea of a fluke or chance result. They hate the idea that history can just happen without being consciously plotted and controlled by some all-knowing person or agency. They hate the idea of the rogue, one-off individual assassin like Oswald, and they hate the idea of the rogue and unrepeatable event like the flight path of an individual bullet. They want the world to have pattern, so it's no surprise that they always end up finding it and end up complaining when other people fail to see it too. My favourite example of the literal-mindedness of conspiracy theory doesn't come from the Kennedy case, but from the related field of 9/11 conspiracy theory. In 2016, an American truther named Paul Salo, set up a crowdfunding scheme that he thought would solve the supposed mystery of 9/11 once and for all. Salo wanted to raise $1.5 million to buy a decommissioned skyscraper and a jet plane. And he wanted to load the plane with fuel and crash it into the skyscraper by remote control to see if the skyscraper would collapse in exactly the same way the World Trade Center had. "We want to recreate the physics of the 9/11 event as much as possible," he said. "People deserve to find out what happened. If there's just a smoking hole in the building and nothing happens, you pretty much know it was a hoax, right? Because it's obvious, right?" Tragically, Salo's plan never came to fruition, but even if he had gone to all the trouble of crashing a real jet into a real skyscraper, the exercise wouldn't have proved anything. Maybe the building would have collapsed, and maybe it wouldn't have. Either way, if Salo really wanted to empirically prove that 9/11 was a hoax, he'd have needed a lot more than just one skyscraper and one jet. For a start, he would have needed at least one skyscraper that had the same unique architecture as the World Trade Center. And to run his experiment properly, he'd have needed more than just one tower like that. Apparently, he'd forgotten that on the day of the actual 9/11 atrocity, even the twin towers themselves hadn't collapsed in identical ways. The North Tower was hit first, but it collapsed second after burning for 102 minutes. The South Tower was hit second, but it collapsed first after burning for just 56 minutes. It would be impossible to list all the different physical variables that caused these two quite different outcomes to happen, but it should be enough to say that each event was unique and unrepeatable. And if the planes had struck the towers at a lower speed or a flatter angle or with less fuel on board or at a higher point of the structure, then maybe one or both of the towers wouldn't have come down at all. When truthers like Paul Salo suggest that the Twin Towers were brought down by a controlled demolition, I think we should pay special attention to the word controlled, because conspiracy theorists always want the world to be under somebody's control. They hate the idea of anarchy and accident. They feel much better if they can believe that events are always being manipulated by some all-powerful group of cartoon human beings, even if these human beings are inconceivably evil. The truth is that we all need to be a bit humble when we start talking about things as complicated as the physics of a skyscraper collapse or the way a bullet should behave when it's moving at 1,700 feet per second. These are just not subjects on which the gut feelings of a layperson or an amateur are going to be of very much use to us. An amateur can't understand the full truth about a building collapse on the spot just by looking at it and having a blinding flash of insight about it. If we want to understand such complicated events properly, we have to acknowledge that our personal intuitions are not enough. We need to listen to people who know more about these things than we do. Common sense does have its uses, but if you use it to make snap judgments about things that you know next to nothing about, you're going to end up with a cartoon understanding of reality. There's a moment in the movie JFK that perfectly illustrates the point I'm making. It happens during the courtroom sequence near the end of the movie. Kevin Costner, playing the DA Jim Garrison, has entered the stretcher bullet into evidence at the trial, and during his closing speech, he pulls it out of his pocket and he invites the jury to just look at it. "Use your eyes," he says. "Use your common sense." Obviously, at this moment, Stone's movie is trying to say the same thing to the viewer. All you need to do is look at the stretcher bullet, and your eyes and your common sense will tell you the truth about it. It's interesting that Stone should suddenly choose this moment to appeal to the viewer's common sense, because in practically every other frame of his film besides this one, Stone spits in the face of common sense. For example, common sense tells us that Oswald's decision to flee the book depository after Kennedy's shooting was an action that reeked of guilt. But Stone's movie tries to tell us that Oswald fled the scene of the crime not because he was guilty, but because he was innocent. He knew there was a problem, is how Kevin Costner explains it. Maybe even that he was a patsy, an intuition maybe. At moments like that one, Oliver Stone is quite happy to behave as if common sense isn't even a thing. But when it comes to the stretcher bullet, all of a sudden, Stone becomes a big believer in trusting the evidence of our senses. In other words, he becomes a fan of common sense at exactly the moment when our common sense is least likely to do us any good. Our common sense intuitions are useful when it comes to judging Oswald's behaviour, because we know from experience how innocent people behave and how guilty people behave. But how many of us know from experience what a full metal jacketed piece of military ammunition should look like after it's passed through two people? Obviously, this is a question we can't answer by just using our eyes and our common sense. We have to defer to the experts, who tell us that, in fact, it isn't impossible for a bullet to pass through two bodies and come out looking like that. In fact, one expert who testified to the House Select Committee on Assassinations said that the nearly intact state of the stretcher bullet amounted to, quote, direct proof that the bullet that struck Governor Connolly's wrist was not at high velocity. In other words, the stretcher bullet did look more or less like a bullet should have looked after going through Connolly's torso and wrist, because if it went through his torso first, it would have hit his wrist at a significantly diminished speed and therefore wouldn't have been deformed by the impact. To be fair to the early Kennedy conspiracy theorists, some of them did have better arguments against the single bullet theory than just claiming that it defied the laws of common sense. Some of them had the integrity to engage with the theory fair and square in a mathematical way. As I explained in the previous episode, the mathematics of the single bullet theory were fairly straightforward. Bullet weight is measured in grains, and the stretcher bullet weighed 158.6 grains. Before being fired from Oswald's rifle, it would have weighed approximately 161 grains. So between leaving Oswald's rifle and arriving on Connolly's stretcher, the bullet had lost 2.4 grains of its original weight. This was a tiny amount of lead. It was approximately the weight of a postage stamp. So to prove that the stretcher bullet hadn't gone through both Kennedy and Connolly, and that their wounds must have been caused by some other bullet, all the conspiracy theorists had to do was show that more than 2.4 grains worth of lead had been left behind inside them. As I said in the previous episode, no lead at all had been found inside Kennedy's body, so really it came down to how much lead had been left behind in Connolly. If there was more than 2.4 grains in Connolly's body, the single bullet theory was sunk. And really, it should have been easy for the conspiracy theorists to find this excess lead if their whole shtick about the obvious fraudulence of the stretcher bullet was correct. According to them, the stretcher bullet was way, way too intact to have caused all the damage it had supposedly done to Governor Connolly. If that was true, then there should have been not just more than 2.4 grains of lead in Connolly's body, but much, much more. If you could prove that there was too much lead in Connolly, you could turn yourself into a conspiratorial hero. But there was some danger in the attempt to find this mythical missing lead, because what if you sifted through all the medical evidence and examined it more fervently and microscopically than the Warren Commission itself had, and ended up finding that the missing lead just wasn't there? That would be a problem. It would mean that instead of proving the single bullet theory wrong, you would in effect have added to the proof that it was right. It would be like getting down into the service trench of the Death Star and aiming your little X-wing fighter at the thermal exhaust port and pulling your trigger and hearing nothing but an impotent little click. And that is essentially what did happen to several of the early critics of the Warren Report. It happened to Sylvia Marr in her book Accessories After the Fact, which was published in 1967. At one point in that book, Marr quoted a sentence from the Warren Report which claimed that all the tiny bullet fragments found inside Governor Connolly were, quote, sufficiently small and light to have come from the stretcher bullet. In other words, those fragments didn't weigh more than the 2.4 grains that were missing from the stretcher bullet's base. Sylvia Marr thought that this claim was a little bit vague and cavalier. She thought the commission should have done its sums more thoroughly. She wrote, "The commission takes no account of the bullet fragment, minuscule though it is, that remained embedded in the governor's thigh bone." Marr sounds pretty confident there, as conspiracy theorists always do. She sounds as if the point she's making is decisive. But in fact, the tiny fragment of lead she was talking about, the fragment embedded in Governor Connolly's thigh bone, made no difference at all to the big picture. When Arlen Specter was taking the testimony of Governor Connolly's surgeon, he'd asked him to estimate the weight of this fragment in Connolly's thigh. And the surgeon had said that it would have weighed, quote, a fraction of a grain, maybe a tenth of a grain. So it was hardly a scandal that the authors of the Warren Report hadn't made any specific mention of this flake of metal. It didn't weigh nearly enough to change the fact that the amount of lead inside Governor Connolly was comfortably smaller than the amount of lead that was missing from the stretcher bullet. In 6 Seconds in Dallas, which was also published in 1967, Josiah Thompson did his sums about the stretcher bullet in a more diligent way than either Sylvia Marr or the Warren Commission had. And when he added up all the specks of metal that were known to have been found inside Connolly's body, including the flake that was embedded in his thigh bone, Thompson found that the total weight of all those fragments came to 1.5 grains. And remember, the stretcher bullet was missing 2.4 grains of its original weight. As Thompson was honest enough to admit, this meant that the critics had been wrong to imagine that the stretcher bullet weighed too much to have inflicted Governor Connolly's injuries. In fact, Thompson showed that the fragments left behind in Connolly weighed almost a full grain less than the amount of lead that was missing from the stretcher bullet. In her book, Sylvia Marr tried to argue the toss about a speck of lead that weighed 1/10 of a grain, but she'd have needed to find at least 10 more specks of metal just like that one if she wanted to prove mathematically that the stretcher bullet was a fraud. The fact that she'd gone looking for that missing lead and hadn't found it strongly suggested that it just wasn't there. Marr gives us a classic example here of something that often happens in conspiracy theory. She loses her sense of perspective. She looks at the evidence from too close up in an unnaturally microscopic way, and she gets so excited by the minuscule discrepancies that she thinks she can see through her microscope that she forgets to straighten up from the microscope and think about the big picture. In fact, something deeply ironic was going on when Sylvia Marr zeroed in on that tiny speck of metal embedded in Governor Connolly's thigh. She seemed to have momentarily forgotten that, according to people like her, the fraudulence of the stretcher bullet was meant to be laughably obvious and plainly visible to the naked eye. In fact, at another point in her book, Marr suggested that the stretcher bullet, quote, may in fact be whole. But within half a page of confidently saying that, Marr was hunched over her microscope, indignantly arguing the toss about a speck of metal in Connolly's thigh that weighed 0.0002 of an ounce, which was around 20 times less than the weight of a postage stamp. The fact that Marr had to concern herself with a speck of metal that tiny should have told her something. It should have told her that the argument was over and she'd lost it. The single bullet theory was obviously true. The fact that the argument had come down to a matter of micrograms proved that. Clearly, the stretcher bullet weighed exactly as much as it should have weighed if it had indeed passed through both Kennedy and Connolly. If it had weighed just a grain more, it would have blown the whole official story out of the water. If it had weighed just a grain less, people like Marr would probably have been asking why more fragments of lead hadn't been found in Governor Connolly's body. But the stretcher bullet weighed neither too much nor too little. Its weight was just right. Conspiracy theorists keep forgetting that this is what official stories should be expected to do if they're true. They should fit reality like a glove, the arguments about them should be expected to come down to a few milligrams or a few millimeters or a few seconds either way, as all the arguments in the Kennedy case ultimately do. The conspiracy theorists carry on as if the official story about Oswald's guilt was this big slapdash fiction, but if the official story was so false and so slapdash, you'd expect it to contain at least one claim or measurement that can be shown to have missed the mark by a very long way. To start with, conspiracy theorists imagined that the single bullet theory was the most slapdash improvisation of the lot. But when they put that theory under the microscope, they accidentally discovered that it was even more bang on than the Warren Commission itself had bothered to demonstrate. This is how a valid hypothesis about reality works. The more you test it against the evidence, the stronger the hypothesis looks, until there's really no doubt left that the hypothesis is a fact. It really should have been game over for the opponents of the single bullet theory when people like Sylvia Marr tried to show that the theory was mathematically impossible and failed in that attempt. But one of the defining features of conspiracy theory is that it keeps failing to notice when it is game over. The conspiracy theorists in this case are so incapable of perceiving reality that they don't know defeat when they experience it. They aim their little X-wing fighters at the official story, and they hit the wall and crash and burn, and then they climb out of the smoking wreckage and proclaim victory. In the case of the single bullet theory, I think we can go further than saying that it was game over for the conspiracy theorists years ago. I think it was never even game on in the first place. To understand what I mean by that, we need to think about the alternative reality that's implied when people claim that the single bullet theory is a lie. In other words, we have to do what conspiracy theorists themselves are always reluctant to do. We have to think scenario. We have to think about what else must have happened if a single bullet did not go through Kennedy and Connolly. So let's imagine for a moment that everything the conspiracy theorists have said is correct. The single bullet was a magic bullet. The bullet found on Connolly's stretcher was just way too intact to have caused all of Connolly's injuries. If that claim is correct, then how else did this bullet come to be on Connolly's stretcher? After all, it must have got there somehow. Obviously, what the conspiracy theorists want us to believe is that the bullet was planted on Connolly's stretcher. Whoever really killed Kennedy put the bullet there to incriminate Oswald. Some conspiracy theorists are honest enough to come right out and say this. In the movie JFK, for example, you see the bullet being planted on the stretcher at Parkland Hospital by none other than Jack Ruby. But other conspiracy theorists prefer not to say out loud that the bullet was planted. They just go on and on about the improbability of the stretcher bullet, and they let the planting idea sort of hang there as an unspoken implication. And there's a reason why most conspiracy theorists don't tend to talk in any detail about how and why the stretcher bullet was planted, and by whom. Because the more you think it through, the more ridiculous the planting idea becomes. I'll show you how quickly the idea starts to fall apart when you think about it rationally. Let's start by asking ourselves exactly why anybody would have wanted to plant the bullet. What would the point have been? To conspiracy theorists, the answer is obvious. It was planted to incriminate Oswald. After all, ballistics tests later proved that the bullet had been fired from Oswald's rifle, so obviously the conspirators must have shot this bullet out of his rifle at some earlier point and then placed it on the stretcher to put a bow on the case against Oswald. But let's look at that idea more closely. In what sense did Oswald really need to be incriminated any more than he already was? After all, Kennedy had already been shot in the head with a bullet from Oswald's rifle. Two large fragments of that bullet were found in the front of the presidential limousine, and when both of those fragments were subjected to forensic analysis, the results showed that the headshot had quite definitely come from Oswald's rifle, to the exclusion of all other weapons in the world. So there was no doubt that Kennedy had been shot at least once with Oswald's rifle. Either Oswald had fired that shot himself, or else the people who wanted to frame him had gone to the trouble of shooting the president using his rifle. If they'd already done that, then why on earth would they have felt the need to plant an additional bullet from Oswald's rifle on Connally's stretcher? That would have been a tad superfluous. But not only that, it would have been downright dangerous. For one thing, there would have been a fair risk that somebody at the hospital would see the conspirators planting the bullet, thus blowing the conspiracy sky high. But over and above that, it would have been a brain-dead move to plant a bullet at the hospital that the conspirators knew hadn't really been fired at the motorcade, because there would have been a big chance that they were putting one bullet too many into the mix, that is, one more bullet than Oswald could conceivably have fired himself. This is a tricky point, but it's an important one, so I'll try to explain it a little further. First of all, remember that Darrell Tomlinson found the bullet on Connally's stretcher at around 1:30 on the afternoon of the assassination. So if somebody did plant this bullet, they planted it within an hour of the shooting. At this early stage, there was absolutely no way of knowing exactly how many times Kennedy and Connally had been hit, and by how many different bullets. Even the person or persons who had shot them couldn't have known that. If we assume that the shooter was Oswald, not even he would have known that a single bullet had gone through both Kennedy and Connally. And if we assume that the shooter wasn't Oswald, the real killers couldn't possibly have known yet how many bullets or bullet fragments would need to turn up to reassure the authorities that all the shots had been fired by Oswald and Oswald alone. Or perhaps it's better to say not how many bullets would have needed to turn up to show that, but how few bullets, because if you were looking to frame a lone individual, a good rule of thumb would be not to plant more bullets than a lone gunman could have fired. The fewer bullets that turned up, the better. In this context, it would have been madness for the conspirators to plant an extra bullet that they knew hadn't really been fired at the motorcade, because when the FBI and the police pieced the evidence together, there was a huge chance that they would realize that there was one bullet too many in the picture. In other words, far from incriminating Oswald as the lone gunman, planting an extra bullet on Connally's stretcher would have been an excellent way of letting people know that a conspiracy had occurred. As things turned out, of course, the bullet found on Connally's stretcher did happen to fit in perfectly with the hypothesis that Oswald had acted alone. But this point didn't even begin to become clear until March 1964, when Arlen Specter started developing the single bullet theory. As Specter developed that theory, it became clear that the stretcher bullet was compatible with the lone gunman story, but only because of the remarkable fact that the bullet had gone through two men. It also became clear, as Specter developed the theory, that the stretcher bullet weighed exactly as much as it should have weighed if it had indeed gone through both men. You have to ask yourself, what were the odds that somebody planted a bullet that just happened to meet both of these fantastic requirements? Remember that Connally was still on the operating table when the stretcher bullet was found. Nobody knew yet how much lead was going to be found inside his body, and nobody knew if any lead would be found inside Kennedy's body. So if the stretcher bullet was planted, the people who planted it had several freakish and fucking staggering strokes of luck. The bullet they planted turned out to tie in perfectly with the single bullet theory and therefore the lone assassin story, even though the single bullet theory didn't even exist yet and wouldn't exist for another 4 months. Also, when all the lead that was still inside Governor Connally at the time the bullet was planted was located and added up, it came to within a fraction of a postage stamp of matching the exact amount of lead that was missing from the planted bullet. And this is despite the fact that the people who planted the bullet had taken the weird step of planting a bullet that had almost no lead missing from it at all, to the point where some people believed the bullet was pristine. If you can seriously believe that somebody planted a bullet that hit all of these sweet spots by accident, then your imagination is a lot more vivid than mine is. And by the way, the conspiracy theorists who can somehow manage to believe all this are the same people who tell us that the single bullet theory defies the laws of common sense and is too magical to be true. In 1975, the American historian Jacob Cohen wrote an article about the single bullet theory that I think deserves to be better known, because I think that in that article, Cohen delivered the neatest single proof we have that the single bullet theory is correct. He proved the theory right, not by talking about ballistics evidence or the laws of physics, but by using simple logic. What he did was he took the alternative theory, the planting theory, and he proved beyond doubt that it was wrong, using a method that's known as the reductio ad absurdum. This involves proving a proposition false by first assuming that it's true, and then showing that it leads to such absurd conclusions that it simply must be false. Here's what Cohen wrote. It's a long quote, but I think it's worth listening to in full. Quote, "Consider the implications of the critic's version of what happened. Clearly, Exhibit 399 had to have been planted by the real conspirators. No other conclusion is possible. Let us try to imagine how that might have happened. Immediately after the shooting, news comes to Conspiracy Central that the president has been taken to the Parkland Hospital. A messenger is sent over to the hospital with a spare bullet fired from Oswald's gun, missing a little lead from its base, though not more than was found in the body. He drops it somewhere next to Connolly's stretcher, as it happens. One wonders, did he inquire, where is Connolly's stretcher? And why not Kennedy's while he was at it? Months later, it becomes clear that this bullet fits neatly into a single assassin theory. All this effort, recall, is part of a massive scheme to hide the existence of a conspiracy from the authorities, when obviously the chances at the time were overwhelming that a bullet from Oswald's gun, dropped randomly and irrationally in the hospital, would point directly at the existence of other conspirators. Also, this version necessitates that the bullet which really hit Connolly, resting finally in the flesh of his left thigh, is missing or was intentionally hidden, and if hidden, hidden before anyone could have known that would be necessary. Readers who suspect me of constructing an evadable reductio ad absurdum are invited to construct a more believable scenario." Cohen wrote those words in 1975, and in the 5 decades since, nobody has accepted his invitation to come up with a more believable planting scenario than the one he outlines, for the simple reason that there is no believable planting scenario, because the bullet wasn't planted. Once again, it should have been game over for the opponents of the single bullet theory when Jacob Cohen wrote those words, and it should have been game over for them yet again a couple of years later, in 1977, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations subjected the stretcher bullet to a process that's known as neutron activation analysis. This process involves putting a sample of metal or other material in a small nuclear reactor and bombarding it with neutrons until it becomes radioactive. You can then read the radioactivity to determine the elemental composition of the thing you're testing. The House Select Committee on Assassinations arranged for neutron activation tests to be run on the stretcher bullet and also on the fragments of lead that had been recovered from Connolly's wrist, which were still in possession of the FBI. The tests showed that the elemental composition of the wrist fragments and the stretcher bullet was identical. In other words, the bullet found on Connolly's stretcher had indeed gone through his wrist, which proved beyond any doubt that it hadn't been planted. One reason I think writers like Jacob Cohen are worth quoting is that they show us that Kennedy's assassination, as well as unleashing a riptide of conspiratorial bullshit, has also produced some very high-quality thinking and writing. And like all the best writers about this case, Cohen acknowledges the magic of reality. In other words, he doesn't try to pretend that Kennedy's assassination was a run-of-the-mill event. He freely admits that the fact that Connally and Kennedy were hit by a single bullet was unusual and strange. The single bullet theory implicates one in an improbability of a high order, he writes. But as he importantly adds, reality does not always follow the laws of maximum probability. Strange things happen, though never impossible things, and accounts of strange happenings must sound strange. End quote. So the strangeness of the single bullet theory is a red herring for Cohen. The theory sounds strange because what really happened was strange. Cohen is like Wesley Liebler. For him, the question that really matters is strange compared to what? And as Cohen himself hilariously proved, the alternative to the single bullet theory, the planting theory, goes beyond just being strange. It takes you into a world that any sensible person will recognize as a cartoon. Another writer who acknowledged the magic of reality in the Kennedy case was Norman Mailer. Right near the end of his massive book, Oswald's Tale, Mailer has a great passage about the single bullet theory. It's true, he says, that the story of the single bullet sounds like a 500-to-1 or even a 5,000-to-1 shot, but one cannot introduce the odds after the fact, he adds. When Mailer wrote that, he put his finger on a fallacy that conspiracy theorists are always committing. They're always introducing the odds after the fact. The way they carry on about the improbability of the single bullet theory, you'd think that the Warren Commission had claimed that Oswald consciously intended to nail both Kennedy and Connally with one bullet. But of course, he didn't. He aimed the gun at Kennedy and pulled the trigger, and the rest was up to chance. As Mailer points out, it's meaningless to say what the odds were against the bullet doing what it did, because the flight of any bullet is a unique event. Or as Mailer puts it, quote, each bullet and the wound it causes has an interrelation as unique as a fingerprint or a signature. Indeed, it is recorded that on one occasion a bullet struck a man's brow at such an angle that the bullet travelled completely around his head between scalp and skull, making a full circle before it chose to exit near the entry point. One can try repeating that shot. By the logic of such an argument, the proof of the magic bullet is that it happened. End quote. That final sentence of Mailer's is worth repeating. The proof of the magic bullet is that it happened. It sounds almost frivolous. It sounds like a piece of circular reasoning. But I think Mailer is making a profound and useful point. Since the hard evidence proves beyond any doubt that a single bullet did go through both Kennedy and Connally, this means that the evidence also proves at the same time that such a shot could have happened. It proves that a bullet fired from a high-powered rifle at relatively close range can go through two men and come out looking like the stretcher bullet looked. Or as Mailer put it, the proof of the magic bullet is that it happened. The single bullet didn't defy the laws of probability, as conspiracy theorists claim. What it did was, it showed that conspiracy theorists have a faulty understanding of what is probable and possible in the real world. The path followed by Oswald's bullet shows us that reality is much more rich and strange and anarchic than conspiracy theorists are capable of imagining. When the Warren Report was being drafted, there was at least one attorney on the commission's staff who thought that the report would be a much stronger document if it openly acknowledged the magic of reality. When Wesley Liebler read the draft of the chapter that dealt with Oswald's marksmanship, he wrote a long internal memo arguing that the text of the chapter should be drastically revised. Liebler thought the text sounded way too dry and matter-of-fact. He believed that the commission should admit on the record that Oswald had been quite lucky to squeeze off two successful shots in the space of 4.8 seconds. As Liebler wrote, quote, "It seems to me that the most honest and the most sensible thing to do, given the present state of the record on Oswald's rifle capability, would be to write a very short section indicating that there is testimony on both sides of several issues. The commission could then conclude that the best evidence that Oswald could fire his rifle as fast as he did and hit the target is the fact that he did so. It may have been pure luck, it probably was to a very great extent, but it happened. He would have had to have been lucky to hit as he did if he had only 4.8 seconds to fire the shots. Why don't we admit that, instead of reaching and using only part of the record to support the propositions presently set forth in the galleys?" End quote. The most interesting sentence there is Liebler's suggestion that the best evidence that Oswald could fire his rifle as fast as he did and hit the target is the fact that he did so. This is a strange-sounding observation. It sounds a bit like Norman Mailer's suggestion that the proof of the magic bullet is that it happened. Conspiracy theorists are fond of quoting this sentence from Liebler's memo, and naturally they have failed to understand the point he was making. They think this sentence proves that the Warren Commission was guilty of dodging or begging the question on the issue of Oswald's marksmanship. But Liebler wasn't begging the question at all. He was saying something very important about the nature of knowledge. He was saying that there's no shame in admitting that Oswald's feat was unlikely, because the fact that it was unlikely can't erase the proven fact that it did happen. The evidence comprehensively shows that Oswald did fire two successful shots in 4.8 or 4.9 seconds, and once again, the fact that he did it proves that he could have done it. Liebler wasn't begging the question because he knew that the question had already been answered. That's what a fact is. It's a question that's been answered beyond any serious doubt. Liebler might have sounded like he was thinking in circles, but really he was thinking constructively. He was accepting what the evidence said, and he was incorporating it into his understanding of how the world worked. Conspiracy theorists are the ones who think in circles by eternally returning to questions that have been fully answered with answers they don't happen to like. The true story of the Kennedy assassination can teach us some important general things about the way the world works, if we let it. And one of the things it teaches us is that a lone gunman with a cheap rifle did once get lucky enough to murder the President of the United States and wound the Governor of Texas with one of the same bullets he hit the President with. If your worldview tells you that things like that simply can't happen, then the Kennedy case proves that your worldview needs to be adjusted. If you refuse to adjust it, then you'll officially be in the business of denying reality, which isn't a healthy business to be in. It's almost time for us to leave the single bullet theory behind, but before we do, I want to briefly tie up some of the loose ends you might still be wondering about the timing and sequence of Oswald's shots. The biggest of those loose ends has to do with the bullet of Oswald's that didn't hit Kennedy or Connolly. We know that Oswald fired a total of three shots from the book depository. The evidence that he did so was overwhelming. That's how many shots the vast majority of witnesses in Dealey Plaza heard, and three empty cartridge cases were found on the sixth floor near the window that Oswald had fired the shots from. But if Oswald fired three bullets at the limo, and only two of them hit the people inside it, what happened to his other bullet? And which of his three shots did he miss the limo with, his first, his second, or his third? The Warren Report was agnostic about that second question. On page 111 of the report, there's a brisk little paragraph that's entitled, "The Bullet That Missed." This paragraph says, quote, From the initial findings that A, one shot passed through the president's neck and then most probably passed through the governor's body, B, a subsequent shot penetrated the president's head, C, no other shot struck any part of the automobile, and D, three shots were fired, it follows that one shot probably missed the car and its occupants. The evidence is inconclusive as to whether it was the first, second, or third shot which missed. The evidence may have been inconclusive, but this is one of those moments in the assassination story when our common sense can be useful to us, because we can put ourselves in Oswald's shoes as he stood there in his sniper's nest, and we can make a reasonable guess about which shot he probably missed with. It doesn't make much sense, for example, to imagine that he missed with his third shot. If he did, that would mean that he'd already blown apart Kennedy's head with his second shot. And why would he have felt the need to fire an additional shot after that? It also doesn't make much sense to imagine that Oswald missed with his second shot. That would mean that he hit Kennedy with his first and third shots and fired off a missed shot in between, meaning that he squeezed off three very hurried shots in a little under 5 seconds. Test firings with Oswald's rifle showed that it would have been physically possible for Oswald to do this, but only just. And common sense tells us that just because Oswald could have fired three hurried shots in that short space of time, that doesn't mean he would have wanted to. This is a man who'd gone to an immense amount of trouble to smuggle his rifle into the book depository and hide it and construct an elaborate sniper's nest in the corner window. He'd only brought a total of 4 bullets with him that day, and as the president's limousine crept past the sniper's nest at 11 miles per hour, Oswald had plenty of time to aim and fire his shots in a careful and deliberate way, so why would he have hurried them? The common sense scenario is that Oswald missed with his first shot, then re-aimed and hit Kennedy in the back with his second shot, then took another 4.8 or 4.9 seconds to load and aim his final shot, which hit Kennedy in the head. And this is certainly the scenario that all the best evidence has converged on in the decades since the Warren Report was published. Computer enhancements of the Zapruder film have shown that the first shot in Dealey Plaza almost certainly rang out right around frame 160 of the film. That is approximately 3 seconds before the shot that hit Kennedy in the back and 8 seconds before the shot that hit him in the head. The Zapruder film is, of course, a silent film, but at frame 160, you can see several people in the film appearing to react to a sudden loud noise. There's a 10-year-old girl who appears in the Zapruder film named Rosemary Willis. She's dressed in a red skirt and a white hooded jacket, and between frames 133 and 160 of the film, you can see her running enthusiastically along the grass on the far side of the road to keep pace with the president's limousine. At frame 164, she suddenly starts to slow down, and she starts turning to look back up at the book depository. Finally, she comes to a complete halt, and she then disappears from the film as Zapruder's camera pans right to follow the limousine. Rosemary Willis said later that she stopped running because she'd heard a loud bang from behind her from the direction of the book depository. Another person in the Zapruder film who seems to react to a loud noise at frame 160 is Governor Connolly. Connolly told the Warren Commission that when he heard the first shot ring out, he knew at once that it was a rifle shot. He said, "I instinctively turned to my right because the sound appeared to come from over my right shoulder, so I turned to look back over my right shoulder." In the Zapruder film, Connolly can indeed be seen turning to look back over his right shoulder, starting at frame 162. Along with the movements of Rosemary Willis, this gives us firm proof that the first shot rang out fractionally before frame 160 of the film, 3 seconds before Kennedy was hit for the first time. And by the way, it also confirms that Connolly was wrong to remember that when he turned around after that first shot, he saw that Kennedy was already slumped over, because as the film clearly shows, Kennedy was still waving and smiling to the crowd when Connolly turned around. If we didn't already know that Connolly was wrong about the single bullet theory, we could work it out from this point alone. In the late 1970s, the House Select Committee on Assassinations found even more proof that Oswald fired his missed shot just before frame 160 of the Zapruder film. The committee subjected the film to a so-called jiggle analysis to see if there was any sign that any loud noises in Dealey Plaza had caused Zapruder to flinch while he was holding his camera. If he did, the flinch would show up on the film footage as a momentary blur. And there did indeed turn out to be a so-called blur episode on the Zapruder film between frames 158 and frame 160. So the evidence seems pretty clear. Oswald fired a missed shot just before frame 160. A little over 3 seconds then went by before he fired his second shot, the one that hit Kennedy in the back, and then a further 4.9 seconds went by before he fired his third shot, the one that hit Kennedy in the head. This means that in total, Oswald took a relatively unhurried 8.3 seconds to fire his three shots. But if Oswald's first shot missed the limo, what did it hit instead? There was a clue in the story of a witness named James Tague. When Kennedy and Connolly were shot, James Tague was standing under a railroad bridge at the lower end of Dealey Plaza, around 520 feet away from the book depository. If you drew a straight line from the sixth floor of the book depository to the place where the presidential limo was at Zapruder frame 160, that line would have more or less continued straight down to the spot where James Tague was standing. As Tague heard the shots ring out that day, he felt a sting on his cheek, as if he'd been hit by some tiny flying projectile. He reported this to a deputy sheriff, who noticed that Tague had blood on his face. The deputy sheriff got Tague to show him where he'd been standing when he'd received this injury, and they found that there was a chunk of concrete missing from the curb where Tague had been standing. Apparently the curb had been struck by a bullet or a bullet fragment, and this had caused a chip of concrete to fly up into Tague's face. The Warren Commission wasn't able to work out which of Oswald's shots had caused this damage to the curb, but these days it's generally agreed that it was Oswald's first shot, the one he missed the motorcade with. We also know that what hit the curb was a bullet fragment as opposed to a whole bullet, because a forensic analysis of the concrete found traces of lead there, but no traces of copper, which meant that the bullet's copper jacket must have somehow become separated from its lead core before a fragment of the core struck the curb. So these days there's a general consensus, except of course among conspiracy theorists, that Oswald's first bullet missed the motorcade, hit some hard object that caused it to fragment, and then one of the fragments flew on down the road and hit the curb where James Tague was standing. There's still no consensus, though, about what the hard object was that Oswald's bullet hit and fragmented against. It's been argued that the bullet hit the road, or the branch of an oak tree, or even the steel arm of a traffic signal mast. This question still hasn't been answered beyond doubt, and it probably never will be. Probably Oswald himself was the only person who will ever know for sure why he missed the motorcade with that first shot and what that shot hit instead. And of course he took that secret to the grave. The other loose end about Oswald's shots that I haven't tied up yet is the famous question of why President Kennedy jerked violently to the rear when he was struck by the headshot. This is a big issue for assassination skeptics. When people tell me that they doubt the official story, this is one of the first questions they tend to throw at me. If Kennedy was shot from behind, why did his head and his body so graphically snap backwards after he was shot, as we've all seen on the Zapruder film? The real-life Jim Garrison said this about the head snap, quote, "You don't have to be a genius. It takes no arguments, no words. When you look at the Zapruder film, you see that the President of the United States was shot from the front, and there's no question about it. He's so clearly hit from the front, the force almost catapults him out the back of the car." You can't blame Garrison for getting a bit carried away there, because the head snap to the rear is another one of those rare moments in the Kennedy case when the conspiracy theorists do seem to have common sense on their side. As we'll see, though, this is in fact another one of those complicated physical events where the common sense reading is a kind of mirage which leads us away from the truth. There is a reason why Kennedy snapped backwards, despite the fact that he was hit from behind. I'll explain what that is in a moment, but first I want to say a couple of things about how the head snap argument has evolved over the years. The head snap first became an issue because of one film, the Zapruder film, and tellingly it was another film, Oliver Stone's JFK, that really cemented the backwards head snap in the public imagination. During the movie's courtroom scene, Stone plays the headshot frames of the Zapruder film over and over again. He plays them a total of 7 times. And as the film plays over and over, Kevin Costner as Jim Garrison keeps intoning the phrase, "back and to the left, back and to the left, back and to the left." He repeats it like a mantra, is what the screenplay says. And this movement to the back and the left shows us, as Costner goes on to explain, that Kennedy must have been shot from the front and the right, that is, from the grassy knoll. The movement of the head is totally inconsistent with a shot from the depository, says Costner. But there's something seriously confusing about this sequence of Stone's film, because as Zapruder's footage of the headshot plays over and over, and Costner keeps saying back and to the left, you can't help noticing that at the same time as he keeps saying that, a horrendous spray of blood and gore keeps bursting forwards out the front of Kennedy's head. If you're using the common sense that Stone and Garrison claim to be such big fans of, you'd tend to think that a huge fountain of blood shooting forward out the front of somebody's head suggests that that person has been shot from behind. But the weird thing is that Oliver Stone doesn't even seem to notice this problem. He's so mesmerized by his own mantra of back and to the left that he seems to be incapable of perceiving any evidence that doesn't fit in with it. Not all conspiracy theorists have been as blind to this problem as Oliver Stone was. The smarter conspiracy theorists have dealt with the problem of the frontal blood spray by claiming that the Zapruder film was doctored. They say that the original film must have shown an eruption of blood flying out the back of Kennedy's head, and this backward spray of blood must have been somehow airbrushed out of the film and replaced by a fake spray of blood shooting out the front of his head. This claim is, of course, pure fantasy. There's absolutely nothing to support it, apart from the conspiracy theorists feeling that it would be nice if it was true. And by the way, if somebody did have the technology to remove a backward spray of blood from the Zapruder film and replace it with a forward spray of blood, then why didn't he get rid of Kennedy's backwards head snap while he was at it and replace it with a forwards head snap? Another interesting historical fact about the head snap is that it isn't mentioned even once in the whole of the Warren Report. The report anticipated many of the arguments that the conspiracy theorists would use against its lone gunman finding, and the report did its best to head those arguments off at the pass, and yet the report didn't so much as mention the head snap, which would become one of the biggest conspiratorial talking points of all time. For some reason, the head snap struck the authors of the Warren Report as a complete non-issue. To understand why that was, we need to remind ourselves of a couple of basic things. One is that the staff of the Warren Commission were living and working in the real world, and they knew for a fact that the Zapruder film hadn't been doctored. The possibility that anyone would ever be desperate or deluded enough to make that argument would never even have occurred to them. So when the commission's staff sat down to watch the Zapruder film for the first time, they knew that what they were about to see was an authentic record of what had happened in Dealey Plaza. They also knew something else for a fact as they sat down to watch the Zapruder film. They knew that Kennedy had been shot twice from behind and zero times from in front. Those facts had been established at Kennedy's autopsy, which once again the staff at the Warren Commission knew to have been an authentic medical procedure as opposed to a cartoon hoax. So as they watched the Zapruder film and saw Kennedy's head and body lurch backwards after the headshot, the authors of the Warren Report knew that this backwards lurch was not hugely significant. They knew that whatever had caused it, it certainly wasn't caused by a shot from the front, because there were no entrance holes in the front of Kennedy's head or body. In other words, they knew the head snap had to have an innocent explanation, an explanation that was compatible with the known fact that Kennedy had been shot from behind. A little bit later, doctors and ballistics experts explained to the commission's staff that when a person's brain is destroyed by a bullet, that can cause spasms of the nervous system and all sorts of strange bodily movements and jerks. This had struck the commission's staff as an adequate explanation of why Kennedy had lurched backwards after the headshot, and they'd moved on to more important questions without feeling the need to mention this one in the report. No doubt they were naive to think so, but they assumed that the autopsy report would be enough to assure people that Kennedy had not been shot from in front. When the House Select Committee on Assassinations reinvestigated Kennedy's murder in the late 1970s, the Zapruder film had recently been broadcast for the first time on American TV, and the head snap had become a big concern for the general public. So the committee questioned several medical experts about it on the record. After hearing their testimony, the committee concluded that Kennedy's sudden lurch to the rear was almost certainly caused by a neuromuscular reaction. Oswald's bullet did catastrophic damage to Kennedy's brain, which caused it to send all sorts of faulty signals through his body. Among other things, this had made the muscles of his body tighten up very suddenly, and since the back muscles are heavier and stronger than the abdominal muscles, Kennedy's body had lurched backwards. As one expert explained to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the neuromuscular basis of this movement meant that Kennedy's body would have lurched backwards no matter what direction the bullet that destroyed his brain had come from, the back, the front, or the side. As for the common sense idea that when somebody gets shot, their body will be spectacularly hurled in the same direction the bullet is travelling in, this common sense idea is actually a myth. It happens in Hollywood films, but it doesn't happen in real life. At the very most, a flying bullet will cause a heavy object like a human body to move maybe a couple of inches in the direction it's travelling in. And in fact, a close analysis of the Zapruder film shows that Kennedy's head did move sharply forward by about 2.3 inches between frames 312 and 313, just after the bullet struck it, and just before his torso and head began snapping dramatically back in the other direction. So here, yet again, you find that the official story of Kennedy's murder doesn't defy the laws of physics or reality, as the conspiracy theorists claim. It simply demonstrates that the laws of physics and reality are richer and more complicated than conspiracy theorists think. Back in 1967, when Josiah Thompson's book 6 Seconds in Dallas was published, John Updike reviewed the book for The New Yorker, and Updike said a couple of very perceptive things in his review about the magic of reality. Thompson's book was subtitled A Micro-Study of the Kennedy Assassination, and Updike pointed out that the micro-study has its limits as a way of getting at the truth. Too much micro-studying can make you start to lose your sense of perspective. It can make you start to see mysteries that aren't really there. As Updike put it, quote, "We wonder whether a genuine mystery is being concealed here, or whether any similar scrutiny of a minute section of time and space would yield similar strangenesses, gaps, inconsistencies, warps, and bubbles in the surface of circumstance." "The search for the truth about those 6 seconds in Dallas," said Updike, "seems to demonstrate how perilously empiricism verges on magic." As Updike suggests there, there are two very different kinds of magic revealed by the Kennedy case. There's the genuine magic of reality, and there's the cheap and false magic that conspiracy theory creates by looking at reality through a distorting paranoid lens. If you look at any event from too close up, as Updike says, you're bound to start noticing all kinds of little gaps and inconsistencies that don't really mean anything. You're going to become obsessed by all sorts of tiny mysteries that aren't really mysteries at all, but pseudo-mysteries. When you pan back from the conspiracy theories about Kennedy's murder and look at the facts in a sane and natural way, you can see that there really are not too many genuine mysteries about the case. But a few genuine mysteries do still linger. The question of what happened to Oswald's first bullet is one of those mysteries. It will probably never be solved beyond question, and even if it is, the answer isn't going to fundamentally change our understanding of what happened. But there is one lingering mystery about Kennedy's murder that might still alter our understanding of what happened if it ever gets solved. This mystery has to do with an incident, or an alleged incident, that happened in September 1963, 2 months before the assassination, right before Lee Harvey Oswald made his abortive attempt to defect to Cuba via Mexico. Anthony Summers, who is the best of the conspiratorial writers about this case, has referred to this incident as the strongest human evidence of conspiracy. Others have called it the proof of the plot. And even if it doesn't offer proof of conspiracy, it's still one of the great legitimate mysteries of this case. I'm talking about the Odio incident, and we'll be looking at this incident in detail next time on The Ghosts of Dallas.
One night I opened a door for three men that came to see one of my sisters. I opened the door, they were in a small hallway with bright lights overhead.
The taller man introduced the other two men. Leopoldo, he said that was his name. He introduced the American who was in the middle as Leon Oswald, and he introduced the one that seemed Mexican and spoke with a Mexican accent as Angelo. The American was introduced as Leon Oswald. That would always be in my mind very clearly.